Glad to see you. It's a wonderful thing to celebrate first novels, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my own foray into the world of novel writing and then do some heavy lit crit for a while on what I think is the best first novel ever to be published, and then suffer with you while we talk about the current state of American publishing, which is undergoing enormous changes even as we speak. While we were eating our canapes, it went into another permutation, and by the end of my brief remarks, it will be in yet another permutation. Buy your Google and Amazon stock, call your brokers now, but then turn your phones off. Here are my bona fides. This is the history of my first published novel, which, like many first novels, was not my first novel, which brings to mind the thousands of witty remarks by the pianist, comedian Oscar Levant, who was a celebrity performer, musician in the 40s and 50s, who remarked once, he says, "I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin." So most of the first novels you read and the first novels we publish are usually the second or third or fourth or even fifth novels that we've written. And we learn the hard way that not so famous aesthetician, but famous TV celebrity Mr. T gave me advice once when I interviewed him for a radio piece. He said, "You've got to learn to turn your obstacles into stepping stones." He said, "Well, they told me that because I hadn't written a book, I couldn't write a book." He said, "That's like saying to my mama, she didn't have any children, so she couldn't have children." Thank you, Mr. T, wherever you are. So I tried to write a novel. I was an undergraduate at Rutgers, and of course I failed. I wrote or typed, you know, 1,000 pages. I think there are a lot of people since the Homers stopped reciting and people started writing on papyrus who have done that. They've written draft after draft after draft, whether on lamb, dried lamb skin or palm leaves or vellum scrolls. Over the one good thing, absolutely wonderful thing about the age of the computer is that writing a novel is not as backbreaking a task as it used to be. So I think I wrote three or four, or typed three or four novel-length manuscripts, but to call them novels is to give them due that they really don't deserve. But I had finished a degree in comparative literature and was casting about for a subject for what I took to be some kind of semi or quasi-scholarly work. I remembered in my childhood that my father, who was a former pilot in the Soviet Air Force, who through a series of misadventures found himself in China and Japan and then San Francisco and New York, used to talk to me about John Reed. And I thought, well, okay. My father thought John Reed was an important subject, the man who wrote, the American who wrote the history of the Bolshevik Revolution called 10 Days That Shook the World. I'll write something about John Reed. And it will be a kind of semi-historical, semi-novelistic, semi-biographical work, and it'll be about 100 pages. And I started to do the research. All of his papers were shipped by his widow to the Rare Books Library at Harvard. And so I went over to Harvard and sat at a desk and with my pencil, you weren't allowed to bring a pen in, and made notes. And I said to a novelist friend of mine, Nicholas Del Banco, I said that I was doing this. And he said, "Well, you're a very lucky man because I have to make everything up, and you'll have all the facts of this man's life that you can turn into fiction, and it's just great." And I thought, oh, that's just great. My friend Nick says, it's just great. I know everything about this man, and I'll be able to write a novel about him. But any of you who have tried to write fiction know very well that knowing everything is as much a curse as it is a blessing, because you've got to know what to throw out and what to condense and what to subtract as much as you have to know what to add. But I wrote a manuscript about John Reed, and I sent it to an editor whom I knew. He was Del Banco's editor in New York, a man named James Landis, who was head at the time of William Morrow. He said he would read it, which meant he would give it to his secretary, and she would read it, and if she didn't die, he might take a look at it. And I waited a couple of weeks, and then I got a very strange, apologetic phone call from Jim Landis. He said, are you sitting down? I said, yeah. He said, well, I have a story to tell you. Your manuscript is missing. I said, really? He said, yes, I had given it to my secretary to read. And someone broke into her apartment and stole your manuscript. I said, what else did they take? Just your manuscript. So this is what happened. This is what happened. He gave it to his secretary to read. This is the spoiler. He called back the next day to say that he got a phone call from a guy at a liquor store on 8th Avenue and said, your name is on this pile of papers that I found on the counter. And it turned out that he gave it to his secretary to read, and she went home that night and bought a bottle of wine at this liquor store and left my manuscript on the counter. Needless to say, when he finally read it, he turned it down. But that, for a while, it seemed like the most romantic thing that had ever happened to me. And I revised it. And a couple of permutations later, I published it. But what do we learn from reading first novels? What we learn from writing first novels is that we are mad. We suffer from a terrible obsession, which is probably second only to wanting to live a life filled with love and family and children and adventures. We learn from reading the great novels, let's say from Cervantes, we learn that a book is a metaphor for the world. We learn from reading, say, Lawrence Stern, that time is an elastic medium that we can shape and form. We learn from, say, Stendhal, that novels are about class and state and matters of family and war and peace. And we learn from reading modern novels. We learn from reading modern first novels that the world is as we sense it, not so much as we imagine it, but as we sense it on our nerve endings. We learn that language is a plastic medium that allows us to shape and form what we think we know, and that real life and the emotions that we feel on the tendrils of our endocrinological system are sometimes beautiful. Let me nominate Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man as the best first novel ever written. I read it when I was a sophomore in college, all the way from the first line to the last. I was around the same age as Joyce's hero, Stephen Dedalus, though not nearly so well educated. I had working class Jersey to thank for being not so well educated, but somehow being in a class with a teacher, and it was an eighth grade teacher who, when she saw I was carrying a copy of a James Joyce of Dubliners with me, announced that he was an evil smutty writer. which made me declare to myself that I was going to read all of Joyce over and over again. Joyce had his narrow island, Ireland, the old sow that eats her farrow, as Daedalus describes the country of his birth in that novel. Ireland with its priests, its strident priests, its doer schoolmasters, its inebriated fathers and demanding God, but it also had a classical curriculum. My New Jersey was much less forthcoming. We had no England bearing down on us, only Manhattan, 20 miles away and across the river, which was almost enough. City life set a standard for us on the west bank of the Hudson, and as soon as we were able, we made foray after foray into Manhattan, at first by bus or by ferry over to Tottenville on Staten Island, and then by rapid transit across to St. George, and then another ferry over to Battery Park. Standing up on that train over a series of Saturdays, I read Portrait for the first time. I'd already tried some Faulkner, and I had a copy of The Sound and the Fury snatched from my hand by a high school teacher during study hall, another declaration. CD book, she said, refusing to return it to me by the end of the day. I remember going to Oxford, Mississippi, making a Faulkner pilgrimage for the first time, and checking in at what at the time was the only motel in Oxford, and the guy behind the desk in his undershirt smoking cigarettes said, "Why are you here?" Kind of like the way a British immigration officer would ask you that same question today. "Why are you here, you stranger in Oxford?" And I said, "Well, I'd come to visit Faulkner's house." "Well," he said, "I ain't read Faulkner, but I read Hemingway. I read a Hemingway book once, and I hear Faulkner's like that, kind of seedy like." But Portrait of the Artist was worse than seedy. Some Catholic kids I knew told me it was listed together with Dubliners and Ulysses on the dreaded index of books good Catholics should not read. The first time around, I had no idea why Catholics might consider it worth banning. As far as I read, I found no obscenities or even euphemisms for obscenities, as in the substitution for, when Mailer published Naked and the Dead, his editors cut out the four-letter word for intercourse and changed it to a three-letter word that no one on this planet ever uses for intercourse, F-U-G. And at the publication party, Diana Trilling, wife of the literary critic Lionel Trilling, came up to him and introduced herself, and she said, "Oh, you're the young man who doesn't know how to spell fuck." But there was nothing like that, as far as I could tell, in Portrait of the Artist. But I read the book after my first sophomoric time around, and I understood why it had been indexed. The story of young Stephen Daedalus' progress from tormented but assiduous Catholic to budding aesthete stands against everything the church would have him believe, even as his serious Catholic education prepared him for arguing on behalf of his aesthetic. Without Aquinas and Augustine, Daedalus might have tarried longer in the chapel, but with Aristotle and the theologians as the wind at his back, he moved faster and faster toward his vocation as a writer, toward the point at which he could look back and write the story of his life and education. The essential self-reflexiveness of this narrative education was lost on me the first time around. I read for the story, as all naive readers do, and God save the naive reader in us. I loved the opening pages. I got lost in the family discussion, skimmed through the middle section until the retreat sequence, and was mesmerized by the depictions of hell no Jewish kid from Jersey ever was raised to believe in. And then I settled into the torpors of sinfulness and Daedalus's subsequent evolution into the aesthete of all aesthetes. I could not have imagined in what good stead the discussion of beauty and its component parts with his university friend would stand me over the years. The long flowing pages of epiphanic wonder close to the end of this book more than repaid the squint-eyed attention I gave to the more scholarly parts. The beautifully noticed details from the eyes of girls among the leaves to the lice crawling over the nape of our hero's neck made up a world I might have felt but never could have imagined. From the first lines, the book pushes the individual soul of Daedalus into the center arena and never moves him out of it. No greater work of modern art turns the spotlight onto the individual artist writer with more intensity, more skill and cunning, and more music than does Joyce's portrait. No greater work of modern art calls the would-be young artist to his vocation with a stronger and more demanding voice. Moreover, this novel makes clear the news that for the modern artist, life will not become complete until he or she has constructed an alter ego in the work to complement the living, breathing artist. In Portrait, the story of humankind depends on the evolution of the writer-artist who is making the story and has as its centerpiece the formation of the intellectual, emotional, and aesthetic soul of the writer as hero. Joyce called attention to this specific quest by the title in his earlier draft, his actual first novel called Stephen Hero, and by invoking in his final version of the novel the mythic artist creator Daedalus, who constructed the labyrinth. As Karen Armstrong has pointed out in her recent book on the nature and role of mythology in human culture, quest stories presented in the form of novels remind us of our needs as creatures seeking some way of knitting together our mortal world and the possibility of worlds beyond our own. Myths give meaning to early culture. The novel gives us the same feeling as myths gave to its ancient believers, even if only for the duration of the reading of the story. The novel, as the 20th century literary critic George Lukács has written, is the epic of a fallen world. While reading, we hold up the world in our hands. And no novel in the Western tradition makes this more apparent than Portrait of the Artist. While Joyce works squarely in the realist tradition, he builds a scene-by-scene portrait of the modern citizen at the highest point in his powers of observation, cogitation, and the tendency towards an always unrealized transcendence. The opening itself has become a myth among modern writers. A life begins on the first page, in language and song, in story and sensation. Reading the opening page the first time around filled my mind with music and swirl, images I couldn't hold together except by the cement of the emotions they engendered. Reading it again now, decades later, I noticed the fragments of early experience shored up by each other. A graduate student of mine remarked on her first impression of reading Portrait. "I was surprised," she said. "It's so modern." I suppose that was a way of describing my own first impression. I couldn't have told you back then, my New Jersey in the late 1950s, what modernity was, but I felt the proximity of the book to my own impressions, to my troubles, and to my yearnings. Here was a handbook for a life in making art. Because of this, it produces a strong effect on a young would-be writer, but this novel creates the impression it does with effects that don't necessarily impress the young reader enough to make him or her lean toward inquiring about the very techniques that yield these effects. Reading the book at 17, I was all wonder and hopefulness, but had no awareness whatsoever of the craft it took to create the portrait of an apprenticeship so supreme. Amazed at the hellfire sermons and at Daedalus's amazement at being in the world, and amazed at the final pages of extended epiphanic wonder, I read stutteringly and ecstatically, which is to say, erratically. "Welcome, O life, I go to encounter for the millionth time the reality of experience and to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race. O Jersey boy," I should say, "you there, standing before the gates of the 1960s, trembling book in trembling hand, what a connection to make, to feel more kinship with a fallen turn-of-the-century Dublin Catholic aesthete than with one of my own family or friends." Reading Portrait again, I find myself focusing on Joyce's prose-making powers. Standing at the nexus of English and Gaelic tradition,
Joyce chooses the former. Standing at the nexus of Latinate and Anglo-Saxon tradition, Joyce chooses the latter. Poised between neo-Victorian and modern times, he pushes strongly ahead, dramatizing Daedalus's education in how to make sentences about the world, and finally, how to make a world out of sentences. He teaches us about the beauty of making language on the page, as when, after communion, Daedalus breathes wine on the Clongowes Wood School rector's breath and takes his awareness of language up a notch. The word was beautiful, he says to himself. Wine, it makes you think of dark purple because the grapes were dark purple that grew in Greece outside houses like white temples. He notices later birds in flight and strikes sentences about these birds. Bird after bird, a dark flash, a swerve, a flash again, a dart aside, a curve, a flutter of wings. He listened to the cries, like the squeak of mice behind the wainscot. But the notes were long and shrill, whirring, unlike the cry of vermin falling a third or fourth and trilled as the flying beaks clove the air. Their cry was shrill and clear and fine and falling like threads of silken light unwound from whirring spools. Sentences at the service of Daedalus' epiphanies make up the large part of the last section of the novel. Sentences strong and beautifully drawn that fuse his inner life with the world around him. The dramatization of his growing awareness of the thin membrane of consciousness where interior life meets the outer world comes to us in sentences and paragraphs of a lustrous beauty. Towards dawn, he awoke. Oh, what sweet music! His soul was all dewy wet. Over his limbs in sleep, pale, cool waves of light had passed. He lay still, as if his soul lay amid cool waters, conscious of faint, sweet music. A reading of discovery, a reading for education, a reading for instruction and vocation, a reading that amazes. The way this particular novel repays the returning reader makes it an exceptional invention. Other novels beckon, they always do, but none like this one. None will have the same effect, none more instructive for the would-be writer about the pain of education, the struggle with family, the search for a vocation, the vision of a world more beautiful than one ever could have imagined if it weren't for that vocation opening one's eyes and allowing one to write about one sees and feels and hears and touches and tastes. This dazzling novel, a first love that happens over and over again. So, some celebratory thoughts galore about a first novel. But what about the second novel and the third novel and the fourth? We're going to take up that question in a little while. The grand old world of American publishing adhered to a model resembling that of the extended family. An editor took you in and you stayed and stayed, publishing book after book with the house that first published you. But today, the publishing model resembles something akin to a sports bar. You get lucky one night and perhaps move on to someone else the next and another the week after. And now the present world, the world of e-books, the world of singles, web publishing, blogs, folds and unfolds and morphs. Even as we speak, the stock you bought before I started speaking is now worthless. Reading doesn't seem to be endangered, ironically enough. It's only writing, an art already difficult enough, which seems to have more pain and troubles piled on to its practice. About 25 years ago, the publisher of a small, respectable house in New York said in an essay that he gave at a gathering of publishers, it's only the books that transmit the culture from one generation to the next that are being squeezed out of contemporary publishing. I think that's what we have to worry about and keep our eyes open to see that that doesn't happen. The e-book invites readers to participate in the enjoyment of work by writers who earn less and less in royalties as their enjoyment increases. So we have more readers, but writers, as if it could be imagined to be possible, earn less than ever before, except for David Baldacci. And with the advent of web publishing, writers proliferate. More and more writers occur. More and more writers appear. Most of them, let's face it, are quite bad. Where the traditional serious new writer, as I first suggested, publishes a first novel, which may be a novel 2 or 3 or 4, web writers seem mostly to type directly onto the screen. Form and taste be damned. There was a radio show that I used to listen to when I was growing up in North Jersey called Naked City, and it had this little rubric at the beginning. New York City, 8 million people, and each one has a story to tell. Now, there are probably only 720 writers in the city who can tell those stories well, but now 8 million people, each of them can have a blog and tell the story in an unmediated and completely reckless and freely underdeveloped way. It's a bit like getting a telephone call from everyone in the telephone directory when you surf the web. The phone is always ringing, and after a while you become frightened, like those babysitters in horror movies. You don't want to pick up the phone. Here at the outset of the 21st century, some publishers are struggling, others are dying, some are blossoming, others withering, and change is everything, which has always been the case, but never before has it become a business ethic or a business plan. Papyrus, palm leaves, vellum scrolls, the published book, the nook, the look, the shook, the crook. The vehicles have changed over thousands of years, but the stories roll on, some being born again, some born for the first time. And first times are what we're celebrating here this evening. So let's fetch a bottle of wine and keep an eye out for the manuscript on the counter of the liquor store where we buy it. It may belong to someone you know. And congratulations to the first novelist. May we read you again and again and again.